Welcome to China Focus. I'm Jim Stevenson. Welcome back to Sarah Williams.
Thank you, Jim. Hong Kong's pro-democracy movement says it won't back down from its fight for free elections.
Japan and the Philippines agree to combat China's assertive stance at sea.
China commemorates the 69th anniversary of Japan's surrender in World War II.
Our roundtable looks at China's property bubble.
And efforts are being made to boost the appeal of consumer goods in China. Hello and welcome to China Focus.
Let's look at some of the biggest news stories this week.
Hong Kong's pro-democracy protest movement is vowing to not back down in its fight for free elections, a day after apparently conceding defeat to Beijing.
In a statement late Tuesday, the Occupy Central with Love and Peace movement insisted that Hong Kongers won't accept failure on their road to democracy.
The group has for months threatened to shut down Hong Kong's central financial district if China does not agree to allow universal suffrage in the 2017 election for the territory's chief executive.
But after China's rubber-stamp parliament on Sunday passed legislation essentially requiring all candidates to be approved by Beijing, Occupy leaders implied they would back down.
Occupy co-founder Chen Qiman told media outlets on Tuesday that Beijing is not likely to be persuaded by more protests. He said the group is close to failure and public support is waning.
The comments were seen by many as an admission of defeat. On Wednesday, the front page of the South China Morning Post asked, "Is this goodbye to Occupy Central?"
Addressing those concerns, Occupy said in its latest statement that it is not correct to say that we have less support from the community after Beijing has made the decision. It said new supporters have joined because they are angry about Beijing's ruling.
Shannon Van Sant reports on the Hong Kong protests from Beijing.
Democracy activists staged large rallies Sunday and Monday in Hong Kong to protest voting reform proposed by China's central government. China says a nominating committee, likely backed by Beijing loyalists, should pick the candidates for Hong Kong's leader. Hong Kong Democratic Party Chairwoman Emily Lau says China is going back on its promises of universal suffrage.
I think Beijing's decision is really appalling, but of course, not unexpected. After all, we are dealing with an authoritarian regime.
Under China's proposal, more than half of the members of a nominating committee will choose two or three candidates to run for the position of chief executive. The committee will be similar in makeup to Hong Kong's current election committee, which is stacked with supporters of China's Communist Party. Activists say this will essentially rule out democracy supporters from appearing on the ballot. The Communist Party Standing Committee spokesperson Li Fei made a statement in Hong Kong explaining the proposal. Fei said significant division and controversies exist in the Hong Kong society on how to fulfill the Basic Laws regulation regarding the electing the chief executive by means of universal suffrage. He said this is especially the case when some people suggest proposals that obviously violate the Basic Law. China's proposal will next have to pass Hong Kong's Legislative Council. Democratic Party officials have vowed to veto it. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
As Beijing ruled out the popular election of Hong Kong's chief executive, a committee of 400 pro-Beijing loyalists quietly re-elected Macau's chief executive, Fernando Chu, Sunday, overwhelmingly with 95% of their votes. He ran unopposed.
Last week, in a run-up to the election, activists managed to organize an unofficial referendum concerning direct election of the chief executive in 2019 that attracted between 8 and 9,000 votes from a population of some 400,000 people.
Sunny Low, a professor at the Hong Kong Institute of Education and an analyst on Macau politics, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the outcome of Sunday's ballot was widely expected.
He got overwhelming support from the election committee members. On the other hand, the so-called unofficial referendum was regarded by the Macau government as conducting something outside the legal parameters of the Macau mini-constitution, namely the Basic Law. So the situation in Macau is that it is characterized by paternalistic rule, but some younger generation of Macau people is hoping that the Macau government will democratize the system a little bit further.
Reuters reports that there were close to 9,000 people who voted in that unofficial referendum by midday Sunday. What numbers do you have, any?
It is around 8,000 to 9,000 people who, quote-unquote, cast their ballots in this so-called unofficial referendum. The number of people showed that actually only a minority of Macau citizens are interested in democratization. Overall, most of the Macau people have enjoyed the fruits of casino capitalism's success and economic prosperity in the past 10 years or so. So this is the reason why most Macau people dare not express their views through this so-called unofficial referendum.
Sunny Low, a professor at the Hong Kong Institute of Education, he says democracy activists in the former Portuguese colony are trying to imitate the style of Hong Kong and Taiwan Democrats. But he cautions that the political culture in Macau is very different. Some 20,000 people marched in May in protest of a bill allowing government ministers generous retirement packages in a rare display of popular protest.
I spoke with VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ai to get his perspective on the reaction in mainland China to Beijing's decision to tighten controls on Hong Kong's voting rights.
Well, the reaction here has been somewhat muted. I think the most fervent responses, really, that we've seen and coverage to what's going on, commentary, has been from state media, kind of defending this whole decision that was made on Sunday, and then also, you know, arguing that there's some kind of foreign plot going on here, that foreign forces are trying to interfere with what's going on in Hong Kong. So that's kind of really what we've seen here.
There was also an election in Macau. It's kind of interesting. These two sort of situations are going on in these special territories at the same time.
Yes, that's right. Although the situation in Macau is a little bit different. The democracy movement there isn't as boisterous and strong as it is in Hong Kong. But the two areas are both seeing a growing attention to this issue of representation in government, and the ability of the public to have a greater say in the election of their leaders. The response in Hong Kong to the decision on Sunday has been kind of interesting in that in the run-up to it, we saw this build-up for Occupy Central, and then the decision came out. There was a gathering that night in protest, and then the next day, one of the co-founders of Occupy Central, Benny Tai, made some comments that led people to believe that he was losing faith in the situation. He said that the Occupy Central movement had failed, and he raised questions about really how much support that the movement could muster, given the decision that was made. Of course, other members of Occupy Central spoke out and said the movement would go on. This is just getting of a long period of civil disobedience. You know, there was quite a bit of different messages coming out in the wake of this.
VOA Beijing correspondent Bill Ide. This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, our roundtable discusses China's property bubble.
Japanese and Philippine lawmakers in Manila signed an informal agreement Wednesday to form an international body promoting peaceful means to settle disputes in waters where they have competing claims with China. From Manila, Simone Orendine reports.
Members of the two congressional delegations have agreed to push for a Parliamentarians League for Maritime Security in Asia within their respective legislative bodies. They stress settling territorial disputes and clarifying claims based on international law. Japan and China have a long-running squabble over a group of rocks called Senkaku in Japan and Diaoyu in China in the East China Sea. Tensions between the two countries have steadily intensified in recent years after the Japanese government bought part of the grouping from a private owner. Chinese government ships have been in those waters ever since. In November last year, China declared the area above the island an air defense identification zone, compelling all craft to follow Beijing's rules when flying there. The United States military does not recognize the zone, and Japan ignores it. In the South China Sea, China has sweeping claims, stating it has indisputable sovereignty over more than 80% of those resource-rich waters. The Philippines accuses China of encroaching on formations it says are clearly within its exclusive economic zone. In 2012, China all but took control of Scarborough Shoal, keeping Philippine fishermen out. In recent months, Philippine surveillance photos have shown Chinese reclamation activity on at least four reefs and shoals that the Philippines claims. Manila filed a case last year with the Permanent Court of Arbitration at The Hague, questioning Beijing's claim to nearly all of the sea. Beijing rejects arbitration and has not responded to the case. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
On Wednesday, China's top leaders commemorated 69 years since the surrender of Japan, Beijing's former colonial occupier in World War II. All seven members of China's powerful Politburo Standing Committee, including President Xi Jinping, attended a ceremony in Beijing to mark the occasion.
China's legislature earlier this year designated September 3rd as a national day to remember the defeat of Japan by China with the help of Allied forces. Japan invaded China in 1931, although full-scale hostilities did not begin until 1937. China estimates over 20 million people died in the eight-year conflict.
Seven decades later, resentment towards Japan still lingers in China and is worsened by the dispute over territory in the East China Sea. Many Chinese are also upset. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe has visited a controversial shrine that includes convicted World War II war criminals among those it honors.
Japan's chief cabinet secretary, Yoshihide Suga, said Wednesday that Tokyo hopes China can look toward the future and not the past. He said Japan and China share the same responsibility to pursue the peace and prosperity of the international community, and it is important to have a future-oriented attitude toward a cooperative relationship in order to deal with the common challenges that the world faces.
Suga said the international community has recognized that Japan has made advances as a peaceful country since World War II.
This is China Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, two old soft drink foes battle it out in China.
Authorities in China's violence-hit Xinjiang region are offering cash rewards and other benefits for marriages between those belonging to ethnic minority groups and members of the Han majority.
The Communist Party-run Global Times reported Wednesday that the policy is meant to promote ethnic unity in Xinjiang, where minority Uyghurs have long complained of policies that favor the Han.
The paper says mixed marriage couples in the southern county of Chimo will receive about $1,600 annually for 5 years. The families will also get health care, housing, education, and employment benefits.
The incentives are emblematic of the sort of policies many Uyghurs say are gradually destroying their traditional culture and religious values and replacing them with that of the Han.
My building has every convenience. It's going to make life easy for me.
The International Monetary Fund has indicated it is concerned about vacant real estate developments in China's second and third tier cities. The organization says it is worried that the situation could hurt the country's economy.
We spoke with two experts, Jonathan Fenby, Managing Director of Research and China Analyst at Trusted Sources in London, and Srinivas Turuvendantai, Director of Research and Managing Director at the Jerome Levy Forecasting Center in New York. We began by asking them about whether they agree about the IMF's concerns.
Yes, I mean, there obviously is a property problem in China. You have to remember the residential private property sector in China was only launched right at the end of the 1990s, 1998. This is still a relatively immature market in which, on the one side, people want to own property, partly because it's seen as the best way, best place to put your savings, given that you get pretty bad returns from putting your money into the banks, and you may not want to take the risk of shadow banking products. Property is there. It's also that young people in China all want to own a property. It's a sign of having arrived, having a good job, and then you buy a property. So there is a big demand for China there, and at the same time, the developers have tended to amass land banks and build up in excess, actually, of the demand. So at any one point, you have quite a lot of unoccupied housing units in China. I was in Huangzhou city in eastern China about a month ago, and they reckoned there that the unsold stock of housing was equivalent to 2 years' demand. So you can see this is quite a volatile, fragile sector of the economy. But it's very important because of the way that it uses up steel, cement and everything else, plus furnishings, plus glass. It's a big, big driver for the Chinese economy as a whole.
And Mr. Thiruvengadai?
Yeah, clearly there is the hard data is lacking, but at the same time, you have lots of anecdotal information about how much there is vacant supply. That's been, you know, in all kinds of stories over the last several years. But, you know, one thing I would like to distinguish between when people think about a housing bubble in developed economy and when they think about a housing bubble in China, you know, the characteristics are very different. Because here in the developed economies, it tends to be accompanied by a lot of household leverage. And so the financial distress happens at the household level with foreclosures. And that's not necessarily true in China. And so you would see a lot of people saying, oh, but they don't have any leverage, and therefore they cannot have a bubble, or it's all fine. That's not necessarily true. You can have a considerable amount of overbuilding at the developer or the builder level, or investors might be holding those properties, and they may be vacant, and they could be holding it as an investment property for a long enough period of time, as long as they can keep getting the financing to keep rolling it over. So at some level, the financing, there is leverage in financing there. It's just in a different place in China. And so the vulnerabilities are very different. The basic point is, as long as those assets don't generate the returns or validate the investment in them, they are going to create financial problems sooner or later. It's just a matter of time.
Well, Mr. Fenby, you alluded to how important the real estate is to China's economy and the ripple effects that it can have, obviously with all the construction materials and furnishings in the homes and that sort of thing. Although the domestic economy in China is still very much in the development stage, and the Chinese notoriously are rather stingy in buying things. How much effect does it have on the Chinese economy from the effect of the consumer?
Oh, this is very important indeed. And for instance, in household appliances, you've had cycles of buying there and replacing household appliances. And spending on the household is a very, very important element, both in buying the property, but then in furnishing it, putting in the appliances and so on, is very important indeed in China. And the other element, which I alluded to earlier, is that in general you get a pretty bad return on savings if you put it into a regular bank deposit accounts. This is less so in shadow banking products, but that's more risky. So the safe place to put your excess money, your savings in China, has been over the last 15 years into property. And property prices have always increased like that. So you've got 100 million, 120 million middle-class people in China who've invested their savings in property. And the leadership in China, the Communist Party and the State Council government, are very much aware that they must not allow a property crash, because that would mean the middle class, this 100 million people who, as I say, have been co-opted into the system, would become alienated, and that would be potentially a danger to stability, to the political rule of the Communist Party.
Well, as consumers do get mortgages, the money does kind of funnel back into the banking system in a sense. Would a banking crisis in China affect economies around the world, much like the U.S. mortgage crisis did back in 2008?
You know, there's one big difference between the U.S. and China. The U.S. banking system is very integrated to the global financial system. And the more important is that the U.S. Treasury bonds function as a global safe asset. and U.S. mortgage assets before the crisis were a big part of the global financial institutions' portfolio. So although the epicenter of the crisis was the U.S., the fallout was all over the place. Like a lot of European banks and financial institutions held CDOs and of residential real estate securities. And so the same is not the case in China. It's not like global financial institutions or other investors are holding a whole lot of Chinese assets. So the linkage for China to the rest of the world is more through the impact of the Chinese economy and its impact on trade and what it will do to the rest of the world. So they're very, very, very different type of crisis.
Yes, I mean, that is absolutely right. And that's the key point, I think, that we always forget. Here's China, you know, probably the most globalized economy in the world in many ways, with all the commodity deals, with all the Chinese exports. But China still controls its currency. It still has a controlled capital account. So you can't get money out of China. I mean, you can do so illegally, and there are lots of ways of doing that, of course. So there is a capital outflow. But one of the key elements for China, although people talk a lot about liberalization of the currency, floating of the currency, liberalization of the capital account, if that happened tomorrow, you would have the biggest property crash the world has ever known, because those middle-class Chinese, who I spoke about a moment ago, would want to diversify their holdings away from property in China into buying real estate or other assets elsewhere in the world. Not because they disbelieve in China, but because they want to be safe.
The Chinese leadership has got to be under a certain amount of pressure, because if there could be, say, an economic crisis, say, to do with the bubble or of a bubble bursting, that kind of thing, I mean, they probably feel a bit nervous about this whole situation.
Well, I've thought for some time, I've been writing about this for quite a long time now, about 18 months, 2 years. I think this anti-corruption campaign is, in a sense, potentially the most important thing that's happening in China at the moment. It was very easy when it started to say, oh, this is another, you know, Xi Jinping, the new Chinese leader, going for his enemies, using corruption for that. We've seen this in the past repeatedly and so on. But I think it has now taken on a much, much wider signification, which is twofold. First, he genuinely wants to make the Communist Party a more efficient instrument of government, if you like. He recognizes the weakness of the Communist Party, and he wants to purge the party, and hence we've had last year supposedly 180,000 officials who were punished. I mean, that's an enormous number there. But at the same time, he's also using the anti-corruption campaign against the state-owned enterprises. And state-owned enterprises in China, the public, the public sector companies, are enormously important in China. They account for about 75% of the market capitalization of the Shanghai Stock Exchange, for instance. This is a major, major change in China. It's a positive change in the sense that it opens up this potential. It's a dangerous change in that a lot of people in China will feel scared, and that could induce all kinds of hesitations, fear, concerns, which would affect all kinds of sectors, including the property sector in China.
Jonathan Fenby, Managing Director of Research and China Analyst at Trusted Sources, and Srinivas Tiruvedantai, Director of Research and Managing Director of the Jerome Levy Forecasting Center.
How does green tea toothpaste or pickled plum juice sound to you?
Those aren't the usual flavors I'm accustomed to.
Well, Chinese retailers are using local taste preferences to battle other brands in a highly competitive market.
Both local and foreign companies, Sarah, are trying to appeal to Chinese consumers, and local brands have an advantage. They know the market.
Coca-Cola tried to head off the competition by offering smaller-sized products, but still saw its market profit dropped by 3 percentage points last year. Meanwhile, rival Pepsi said it was working with a local research center to develop products that would appeal to the Chinese market.
Now that's a true Pepsi challenge.
I'm up to my knees in zero calories. Pepsi to the max, so let's drink all of these.
We're thrilled you could join us for China Focus, and we'd like to hear from you. You can email us at voaasia@voanews.com. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Sarah's handle at VOA Williams. I'm at VOA Stevenson. And take a look at our program page at voanews.com/China Focus.
That's it for our show. I'm Sarah Williams.
And I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for listening to China Focus.